No, the whole extraterrestrial thing is not a viable solution to this.
We need to go through a turning point in the study of this whole domain, away from ideology. We're not here to prove that we're being visited by, you know, aliens from this planet or that star. That may very well be true, but we have not done the basic work.
I have this hunch that this phenomenon is comes from some sort of domain of pure information, and the fact that it can interact with us at all suggests that that we inhabit a domain that's also pure information.
Are we go conditioned here? Yes.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you great.
Right, sir. So let's begin. How long do you need me for today?
As long as you can talk, but normally they're 2 hours. Sometimes they come in under that. Sometimes they go on over it. It depends. I don't even care if it's 1 hour. It doesn't really matter.
Okay, we'll see how it goes, and you know, whatever you let me know if it starts to dry up.
No, it won't do that, because the only time I talk to people is when it's interesting. And in fact, if somebody is not interesting, I start pulling the conversation in a direction I want it to be that's interesting.
Okay,
I don't think I'm going to have that problem with you, though.
Right. Well, you know, yeah, I mean, you can talk to me about my group to Magonia Exchange. You can talk to me about Vali, what I've done with him.
Yeah.
You know, with Martin Schoff, and then...
Yeah.
There's this whole other dimension to me, which is my life in Spain, too, because here I've just started a new version of my research group in Spanish.
Uh-huh.
And I've been here for 25 years and had plenty of adventures, and I saw a UFO and God knows what. So, I mean,
okay, we will ask that. Question number 5, why did you move to Spain? So that's in there.
Okay, that's good then. All right, I'm just going to get a glass of water. I'll be exactly 20 seconds.
Okay, no problem. Maybe I'll do the introduction while you're doing that. See, Chris is getting a glass of water right now, so I'll do the introduction, then he'll come back and go, what the hell's going on? Let's see. Chris Albeck was born in London. His interest in the historical and sociological aspects of unexplained phenomena began at an early age. He moved to Spain when he was 19, which we'll talk about. He's a student of language and folklore and has helped to compile the largest collection. I'm doing the intro right now.
Sure.
Of pre-1947 UFO cases in the world through the Magonia Exchange, a collaborative network of librarians, students, and scholars of paranormal history. Chris is the author of 3 books with more on the way. The first, Wonders in the Sky, was co-written with Jacques Vallée in 2009. The second is Uparts, in Spanish, Objetos Fuera de Su Tiempo, co-authored with Juan José Sánchez de Oro in 2015, and Return to Magonia, co-authored with Martin Schoff, I think that's how he pronounced it, in 2015 as well. In 2008, he was awarded a prize for his contributions to the field by the Spanish organization Fundación Anomalía. Are you back yet?
Yes, I am.
The show is exceedingly informal, to the point of incompetence at some points.
Perfect. Thank you.
So the first thing I ask everyone usually is, what got you interested in the subject? You know, in anomalies or UFOs or strange stuff in general.
Well, when I was about 13 years old, I stumbled upon a book which was Return to the Stars by Eric von Däniken, which was, of course, his ancient astronaut book, his second one, after Chariots of the Gods. And it was just in a pile of old Marvel comics, because when I was 13, I used to collect science fiction comics. And it looked interesting enough. It was just a mangy old paperback. It looked like it had been dragged across the ground several times over. But I bought it anyway. It was like 20p. And it changed my life. In the sense that, you know, as I opened it up and all these black and white photographs just fell out of the middle onto the floor, I realized that it was interesting. It was different from anything I'd seen before when I was 13 years old anyway. And it was full of mythology, archaeology, and this strange speculation that maybe our ancestors had come from other planets. And I don't know what it did. It triggered something in my mind which has lasted with me, you know, over the last 31 years. From that moment on, I started to buy every book about this subject that had ever been published, which is quite difficult because in the 1970s and 80s, there was a massive boom in ancient astronaut literature. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I joined the Ancient Astronaut Society, which was founded by von Däniken and his lawyer, Gene Phillips. And I was a member there for several years, and I started corresponding with authors and writers who never knew that I was only 13, 14, 15 years old. And that's how I got into it, I suppose.
And so you kind of branched off from that. I remember one of the first books that really affected me, strangely enough, was Inside the Spaceships by George Adamski when I was very little.
Yeah.
So the same thing, you know. Well, how do you feel about the ancient astronaut? Well, I know how you feel about it, some of the stuff we're going to talk about. It's not in the same way that von Däniken talked about it, but as a historical perspective, I think that's kind of stuck with you.
Well, yeah, because I'm very interested in, you know, I'm not so interested in what the truth is behind most of these mysteries. I'm more interested in how they've evolved over time. I'm interested in, you know, their impact on human civilization and mentality and, you know, our vision of the world. So the ancient astronaut theory these days appeals to me because its history is something that's been totally forgotten by most people. That is, it started in the year 1823, and most people don't realize that. It began as a kind of scientific movement or genre, perhaps, in scientific circles in France, right at the beginning of the 19th century. And at that time, they speculated that possibly a planet in our solar system had exploded and scattered remnants of an advanced civilization across the Earth. And that's how they tried to explain what they considered to be uparts at that time, objects, you know, out-of-place artifacts. Mm-hmm. So, the first book published on this subject in 1823 only discussed two giant iron helmets, which had been found, I think, in Africa. And that was the only physical evidence that there was. But they had this whole system of planets, which were like inhabited planets in the solar system, which at one point or other, you know, one had exploded or they collided in some way, scattering living beings and dead people and the Easter Island statues and everything else, you know, all over the world. And that's, what, 150 years before von Däniken. So I'm interested in why we've collectively forgotten that the ancient astronaut theory is so old and why it developed, you know, to begin with.
It's funny when, you know, listening to a couple of your other interviews and also reading through some of your work, I realize a lot of things that that people think are new, quote unquote, at least in the UFO world, are not at all. One of them actually, and this is down on my list of questions, but I don't care, but one of them is the term flying saucer. Mm-hmm. I know people keep thinking that it came from possibly a news report after Kenneth Arnold, but as you mentioned a few weeks ago, I think on Coast to Coast, it's at least 50 or 60 years older than that.
Yeah, that's right. One of the first things I ever did when I had access to a digital newspaper archives was to put the word flying saucer in there, because I suspected that it was probably in use at a different time in history before 1947, but I didn't know, you know, how or when or who might have used it or for what purpose. But I'm interested in language. I'm interested in the origins of typical expressions, common phrases, and, you know, etymology is one of my passions. So I put in there flying saucer. And of course, I saw the usual results, 1948, 1951, 1947. And then I began to find, I mean, this was about 14, 15 years ago. I began to see that the word flying saucer kept popping up in articles from 1920, 1918. And, you know, when you're doing a search in a digital newspaper archive, which they've really exploded these days. I mean, it's fantastic. There's been a boom of this kind of thing. Most libraries are trying to digitize their collections. So mm-hmm. you can access them. Either you pay like a subscription annually to access certain newspaper titles, or you can go into all of these free archives. Anyway, when you do a search, you get a fragment of text. And I was amazed, just looking at the search results, that flying saucer came up in sentences like, flying saucers are knocking planes out of the sky, or people are shooting at flying saucers which are zipping over a lake. And I thought, what the hell is this? So, you know, I began to look at the search results, and I realized that it was simply a term used in trap shooting since the beginning of the 20th century. And at the end of the 19th century, in fact, there was, these little discs used in trap shooting were patented. I think it was in 1882. I'd have to check that. Mm-hmm. But from that point onwards, people were referring to these as flying discs or flying saucers. And what I found was that the term flying saucer was used constantly, continuously, in the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, even up to 1947, but prior to Kenneth Arnold's sighting. And there was a situation in which, I think it was 1944, when a military man called Major Arnold, completely different man, introduced trap shooting into practice sessions for gunners, so they would be firing at flying saucers in the sky to practice for when, you know, when they entered a battle situation. So just 3 years before, a completely different man called Arnold was talking about flying saucers in national newspapers. And in my opinion, this can't really be a coincidence. I think that the question is that the term flying saucer had been used so much over a 40-year period that when it was used to describe what Kenneth Arnold saw, it just came very naturally to the journalist who said it. And then people who read the article already visualized something in their mind that was round and flat and flying in the sky. And In my opinion, and I think in Martin's too, Martin Schoff, who wrote Return to Magonia with me, and we have a chapter on this, it helped perpetuate the idea that UFOs are circular and flat. But you know, if you look at YouTube these days or in any magazine, most UFOs do not look like flying saucers. Even if you pick up a newspaper from the 1947, 1948, someone will say, "We saw a flying saucer. Wow, what did it look like? Oh, it was triangular, and it didn't even look like a saucer. It's just a term that was invented. Well, it wasn't invented. It was a term that was applied to strange objects in the sky, but itself sort of lost its original meaning of round and flat. But it certainly helped perpetuate this myth in science fiction, because you know these days, if a child draws an alien, he'll draw a circular, saucer-shaped spaceship in the sky.
Yeah, they're not going to draw triangular ones or amorphous blobs or globes or anything like that. It's always this flat, circular. Actually, I never really thought about it that way. In this particular way, it would seem that, as you suggest, that the term has actually sort of been bad for the field, because if something doesn't conform to that idea, either people will force it into that idea in their recollection, or they just won't report it, or, you know, it seems that the language seems to have changed has affected research and observation and all that to the point where it's probably not a good thing.
Well, yeah, you can see that a lot when people get very excited when they find historical reports like 17th century, 16th century of disc-shaped objects in the sky. They might not get very excited about a cubed-shaped object or one that looks like a spoon. But if it's round and flat, they say, "Oh my God, it's an actual UFO from the 17th century." Mm-hmm. People get excited about the shape, but it's just like a mythological construct. It's a mistake to think that flying saucers are round and flat. Generally, they never were, and they're not today either. And honestly, I think it was just introduced in 1947 accidentally, and it stayed with us. It doesn't mean that there aren't UFOs shaped like a saucer,
right?
But it does help us distinguish between authentic cases and not authentic cases, because you know if someone comes up with a description of what they've seen and they say, "Oh yes, it looked like a classical flying saucer," I don't know. I do feel a little bit suspicious about their testimony. You know, but I don't want to criticize anyone. And, you know, if there are flying saucer-shaped saucers or UFOs everywhere, that's great. But I do think that, you know, this is something important to bear in mind. It's like question. Little green men. You know, people draw little green men. The expression "little green man" has existed for a very long time. And it just rolls off the tongue, little green man. It just sounds so natural to us these days. The same as flying saucer.
That's funny. The first one of the first songs about UFOs that are even weird things that I remember is a song called "Little Blue Man."
Right.
You know that song, right? Anyway,
no,
really?
I don't know. No,
I'll send it to you. Actually,
people.
You can just go on YouTube and type in "Little Blue Man."
Okay, I will do.
I think it's from the late 50s, early 60s. Anyway, it's a very strange song, and it's very absurdist, about a woman with a blue man following her around saying that he loves her, and she goes nuts and tries to get rid of him. Anyway, I did a search on "Little Blue Man," and of course two or three accounts came up of people seeing little blue people.
yeah, there are some. Yeah, they're not all Smurfs. Yeah.
Did you find any that you can recall in your historical research?
Yeah, I mean, over the years, you know, I mean, my research group, Magonia Exchange.
I just joined it. I think at least the Yahoo group.
Oh, great! Yeah, that's the one. I mean, over the years, it's collected about 30,000, 40,000 accounts. You know,
wow.
So obviously, yeah, we'll find little blue men, giant blue men, little green men, little yellow men. You know, whatever you want, we have it basically. So there are, and then of course in mythology, it's not completely, it's not too rare to find blue skinned people and, yeah, but you know, these days there's just so much information, and
I think Krishna's blue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true. I mean, these days you can find whatever you want. It's like this old idea that you can find an expert to support any theory, any yeah. crazy theory, you know, that you have, or statistics can prove whatever you want. Well, there's just so many stories out there. There's so many accounts of sightings and encounters of all kinds that you're going to find exactly what you're looking for every single time. A few years ago, I had my friend Kay Massingill help me with a project, which I haven't written it all up yet. It's something that I've got there pending to be finished. It's about objects that fell from the sky over time. And, of course, there are rocks, and I've got a big collection of spaceships, even from the 19th century, or meteorites with hieroglyphics on them and so on. But I was interested for a time in food, the stories about food that had fallen from the sky. So I said, wouldn't it be great if we could imagine a whole, like, dinner, like a banquet? let's start with, for example, bread. Is there any account of bread? Of course there is. You can find stories of bread falling from the sky. That's great. What about wine? Plenty of those. Yeah. Wine? Yeah. Okay. Beer? There's plenty of beer falling from the sky too. Oh, that's good. Water. You know, water we have already. And of course that's rain, particularly in England. And then you get into the different kinds of vegetables, tomatoes. Yeah, there's stories about tomatoes that fell from the sky at one point or another. You know, potatoes, meat. And then you can get into stranger realms. You can find stories of custard that fell from the sky, or chocolate or candy, and so on and so on.
Yeah.
So we covered the whole dinner experience, and, it just means that whatever you're looking for, you're going to find it, because there's just so much to find.
Yeah. Well, how about, let's talk about Wonders in the Sky. I was going to say, how did you come up with the idea for Wonders in the Sky? I think we've been talking about that for the last 20 minutes.
Yeah. Well, Wonders in the Sky grew out of a project that I started myself in the late 1990s. I'd never seen a computer before till the year 1997. I was living in a small town in Spain, called Cáceres, a sort of medieval type town. The first time I found a computer, I thought, well, I'm going to start writing up notes, because I'd been writing articles and things for several years, but always using pen and paper.
Yeah.
And then I realized that I could start an actual book, a kind of a chronology of UFO events. And at that time, living in Spain, where there weren't really too many bookshops around for me to consult, I didn't have access to web pages. There was no Google, Amazon, and so on. I didn't know if it had already been done. I didn't know if there were books presenting a long chronology of UFO cases. And so I started one myself. And I actually called that book at that time Return to Magonia, which is a title that I use later on in life. But anyway, I began writing all that up. And then I found in a forum Jacques Vallée's email address. And I thought, wow, I can send him an email. And I'd never used internet before. So that was the first time I'd ever sent an email in my life. And I said, I sent it to him. And about 5 months later, which was like the next time I saw a computer, I actually got the reply back. And then, you know, in early 2001, I decided to really get into writing all this up. Then I started my research group, Magonia Exchange. I got Jacques Vallée to come into the group. And then in 2003, I went to visit him in Portugal, where he was giving a speech there at a conference. And that was great. I met him and his wife, Janine, who sadly died since then. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, let's write a book together. That, you know, it'd be excellent. I'm calling the book anyway, Return to Magonia and so on. Mm-hmm. And he said no. which is a shame, because it took about 9 hours to get to this place on a train. And I was pretty nervous meeting him and whatever. I was very tired when I got there. But he was too busy at that point with other projects. And then I returned to Madrid, where I was living then. And one day, a few months later, I was walking around the supermarket looking for cheese. And he called me and he said, hey, let's do that book together. And I said, wow, okay. And that's how it all started. And then we just started exchanging cases and deciding what went into the book.
Yeah,
I think I answered your question in great detail there.
You should answer my questions in great detail, because we have lots of time and you should be able to see. You are allowed to say whatever you like for as long as you like. And in fact, you can be, you know, conversational about it, which we are being. My next question was, you know, how did Jacques Vallée get involved? Obviously you've answered that. What was the process of putting together the book like? What was the working relationship and how long did it take?
Well, I sent him my manuscript, the one that I've been working on, and with all the cases in it, the one I mentioned before, which I started the first time I ever saw a computer. And he liked that. And but it wasn't a very complete list, because it's only been through the network of scholars and researchers that we were able to create through Magonia Exchange from 2003 onwards that we've actually been able to bring together so many cases, you know, good cases from all around the world, because we have members in so many different countries. Through the group, we managed to add cases and add lots of new accounts and improve the ones that we'd already collected using the original sources. So it was just a question of exchanging things between us, through the email. And that was a process. I think it was about 2.5 years altogether, but it was working on it pretty constantly, because to get to the 500 cases in that book, we had to wade through possibly 5,000, 6,000, you know, because there's just so many. And half of them are just meteorites and comets, or didn't exist at all, or were made up in 1965 or something like that. And some have just came out of novels and dropped into UFO catalogs and so on. So we had to get through all of that, to distill all of that into a collection of 500. And, you know, it worked quite well. The book contains some very good stories. And, you know, that was published in 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. And since then, we've been able to improve a lot of those too, getting better translations, correcting mistakes. So the next edition of that will be a revised one, and we'll correct, you know, all the little typos and problems with it.
Yeah, along those lines, how did you choose what was going to be included in the book? In other words, how did you weed out things that were misidentifications and hoaxes and all that? What was the criteria?
Well, for that particular book, we wanted to try to get cases that had a date and a location. I think those are the two main criteria, because without a date, we couldn't put it in the chronology, and without a location, I mean, it doesn't seem right to just stick a story in there without saying where it happened. So we tried to carefully collect cases only with a location and a year, at least. But fortunately, these days, with the digitalization of the world's libraries, we were able to access genealogical information, which wouldn't have been possible 10 years before, or even 5 years before, probably. For example, using web pages like Ancestry.com, which is fantastic for researchers. You go in there, you can put in the name of a witness or any member of their family, and then you can create a sort of family tree of all the people who would live in a particular house. Then you can get from a different source a map containing all the houses along that street. You can find out who the neighbors were, whether the town actually existed or not, obviously, and these people, that's always an important question. You can build up all the backstory to the witnesses, and by doing more searches in dedicated newspaper archives on the internet, you can find out whether the same people ever reported anything before that or after that, or if they died in a mysterious circumstance. So all of that is very useful to decide what goes in the book and what doesn't. But at the same time, because of this network of scholars which we've developed over the years, we were able to access the original text, whether that was in Latin or like medieval texts, or in Old French, or in German, or in Russian and other languages. So, you know, by collaborating with people across the world, for the first time, we were able to bring together so much original information. I don't think anything had been published like this before that. And since then, very little, I suppose. But I'm hoping that in the future, using this kind of methodology, we can improve UFO research a bit and keep on, trying to become more academic in our efforts to get to the truth, or to get as many cases as possible together.
Yeah, or get to some sort of place where different questions are being asked, or I don't know, the right questions. I don't even know what the right questions are. You know, the right questions are coming through just going back and doing something like you and your colleagues and Jacques Vallée does, which is, let's see where we came from, and possibly this can tell us if we're just going around in circles or going forward. This is why.
Yeah, it's a difficult question, because the problem with ufology is that there's a lot of interest in what's happening now, plus what might be happening, and they're not telling us. But if UFOs have been around for as long as people believe they have, then we have to start looking at historical sources and trying to find out, I don't know, what they were doing before 1947. I mean, it's the only way ahead, I think, for ufology, because after 1947, the information was so contaminated by the media circus that tried to turn flying saucers into the next big thing, you know, for newspapers and so on, that it's very difficult to trust stories published after that date. So I think that the best thing that we can do is to look back in time, you know, to a time when people were a little bit more innocent and there wasn't this huge mythology about abductions and flying saucers.
Yeah, meaning there was less of a cultural and psychological, maybe even subconscious, maybe most importantly subconscious idea of what somebody might be seeing when they saw something strange.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's because the earliest book published that interpreted a UFO as an extraterrestrial craft was in 1857. Before that, although UFOs had been seen for a very long time, nobody had reached the conclusion that these were alien visitors from other planets. And it was only after 1857 that sometimes sporadically writers put two and two together and said, well, if these strange things in the sky are behaving in an intelligent fashion, they must be steered by visitors from other worlds. So, really most UFOs before Arnold weren't really interpreted as extraterrestrial. Even Arnold's sighting wasn't originally thought to be extraterrestrial in origin.
Right. What was it? Oh, that's right, because he didn't know what it was at first. Is that that was more of a creation of the media storm that came after it, I would think.
Well, yeah. I mean, most people didn't know what flying saucers were at all. If you look back at the newspapers published at the time, you know, in June, July, August 1947, what you find is that no one knew what flying saucers were, but very, very few people thought that they were extraterrestrial. So they thought they could be all a big joke, or it could be a secret weapon maybe sent over by the Russians, the Chinese, the Japanese. I mean, this is just after the war, you know.
Yeah.
So there were competitions in newspapers. The first person to bring us an actual flying saucer wins a prize. It could be $10 or $100. And radio stations offered small cash prizes for anyone who could bring them a flying saucer. The idea that anyone could carry a flying saucer under their arm into a radio studio, it suggests that people still had the idea of saucer, the actual word saucer, in their mind. And there are a lot of pranks at the time, mm-hmm. when people threw paper plates out of fifth-story windows to excite others on the street in a small town, or I think in one case in Chicago. And people said, my God, it's raining flying saucers. Let's grab one because we can get a prize for this. We can take this, you know, to a newspaper or a radio station. So no one knew what they were at all. There were jokes all the time about maybe this was inflation of the currency, of the dollar. So they were comparing flying saucers to coins. I don't know. So the idea that they were extraterrestrial didn't really sink in for some time.
What was this book in 1857 that you mentioned, which was the first one that equated flying aerial phenomena with intelligence from other worlds?
Yeah, it's an interesting story in a way, because there's a book published called The Illustrated Silent Friend, which was published in 1858. And it was by a guy called Dr. Earl, who said that, it was basically a collection of traditional magic spells, how to turn yourself invisible, how to stop thieves, like paralyze them like Hero from Heroes. And so on, using traditional magic. And among all of these little spells and things and recipes, very strange recipes, like eating a snake mixed with mercury could cure your liver or whatever it was. there were these stories. There's this one story about a vehicle, an aerial vehicle, that had that had been seen over a small population called Jay in Ohio. It didn't say when it had been seen, simply that the neighbors had come out, they'd looked up, and it was this large craft with, it was piloted by beings that were 12 feet tall, and they had machines and things, and this guy said, well, you know, this proves that intergalactic people have visited the Earth. Anyway, so I looked into this book, and I was studying this for about 3 or 4 years, trying to get as much information as I could, when I discovered, finally, that it had come out the year before in a book called The Magic Mirror by a completely different man called Monet. And so basically it was a pseudonym. It was a different pseudonym used every time. And this book was published until the early 20th century. It just came out again and again and again in different editions, published under different names. And it was most of it consisted of documents stolen from other books. And so I haven't found yet where they got this story from. But I do know that Jay, Ohio, it was a small town that existed, a very small town that existed in between 1837, I think it was, and 1839, which means that the actual sighting would have occurred in the late 1830s. And I went there to this exact place with my friend Kay Massengill, who's a researcher and another member of Magonia Exchange. And I stood in the field where this small town would have existed 170 years ago and looked up, and I thought, wow, this is the first, you know, this is the place where UFOs were first associated with extraterrestrials. So yeah, and then there's this whole backstory there to it, which I'm still researching, which is about doctors, because these books were published by a band of fraudulent doctors who were selling quack medicine to people, probably poisoning them.
Yeah,
and
mercury.
They were arrested in the end, and it's a very interesting story, which I hope to tell one day. Anyway.
Yeah, when I read some of these accounts and based on what you were just saying, I wrote this question down as you were talking. What, I'm trying to phrase it properly. Do you notice, how much the people's beliefs and views and all of that at the time influence how they report things? And, you know, how do we interpret that now? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, at the time, of course, most people didn't really believe in extraterrestrial visitors. I mean, if it all started really, I mean, the whole idea of extraterrestrial visitors started at the beginning of the 19th century, when the link was made between meteorites and outer space. Because before the start of the 19th century, it wasn't, I mean, people didn't really know where meteorites came from. So there were all these theories that had stemmed from the old Aristotelian theory of the universe, which implied, well, basically in Aristotle's cosmology, there is no other planet beyond the Earth. Earth is like a self-contained world in the middle of nowhere. I mean, extraterrestrial civilizations didn't really exist. But what happened was that some of Aristotle's theories, like about meteorites, were still popular until the 18th century, even though people were already talking about maybe inhabited planets did exist in other parts of the universe. So it was a bit of a mess, basically. It's even quite difficult to describe. So what was happening was people didn't want to accept that a meteorite might come from outer space But at the same time, they did believe that space could be populated by alien civilizations, although nothing from those planets could reach the Earth. So when finally it was shown that meteorites had been coming from outer space, this opened up a whole new window on the past and a whole new world of possibilities. And they said, well, if a meteorite is a part of a planet, or if it's come from another part of the universe where we now speculate that there could be extraterrestrial civilizations, maybe that meteorite contains a remnant of another world, of one of those civilizations. So all this idea of speculating about extraterrestrial visitors started with meteorites and the possibility that a meteorite might contain the germ of life, a seed, or even a hieroglyphic, which became quite a popular journalistic genre in the 19th century, with lots of stories about meteorites arriving on Earth covered in alien writing. And then this mutated into meteorites which were hollow inside, with compartments that could contain a manuscript or an animal, and that animal might be alive or dead or mummified or who knows what, but maybe there was an actual person inside, and maybe this isn't actually a meteorite but a vehicle from another planet, and so on and so on. And that's how it all started. So even though before that period, people, if they saw a strange being in the street, they'd have thought it was a ghost or a devil, a spirit of some kind. After this scientific revolution in which they began to realize that things could come from outer space, there was speculation about extraterrestrials. So to answer your question, I mean, how did they interpret strange things that they saw? Well, at the beginning, it would have been all about angels and spirits and devils and things. But after the first decade or so of the 19th century, some people thought, yeah, maybe it could be aliens, it could be extraterrestrials. But even so, because there was no, flight didn't exist yet as such, no one had invented dirigibles that could move between worlds or even between countries properly. They just had hot air balloons. They still couldn't imagine very easily how aliens could travel from one part of the universe to another deliberately. So it was still a long process before they reached the conclusion that, yes, aliens are visiting us. But so when we look back on that period, we have to think, well, what year did this happen in? And at that time, were people imagining already alien visitors, or was it still all about ghosts and spirits?
Yeah. So that brings up another, you know, a related question. I'm trying to phrase it properly, but does it necessarily follow from what you just said, as people contend now, that we just know more now? Because I don't think that's a valid model. Just because we think we know more, does that mean we're closer to the truth about the origin of whatever these strange things are?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I don't know what they are. I don't think anyone knows what they are. I mean, UFOs are classified as mysteries because they are a mystery. Mystery meaning that knowledge of what they are isn't something that we actually have. So, I mean, in the past, no one really knew what they were, and you know, nothing's changed in that sense. I always find it interesting when you go back 50 years. And you find people discussing, you know, what are these things? The truth is going to come out very soon. Mm-hmm. And then you go back 50 years more, and they're saying exactly the same thing. You know, oh, the truth isn't going to take long. You know, it isn't going to take long before the truth comes out. And we all know what these things are. And 100 years before that, people were saying practically the same thing. Nothing changes in that way.
Not really. It sounds like we're moving our own goalposts all the time.
Yeah, it's a bit like, you know, people who predicted the end of the world. You know, it's always going to happen in 3 years' time, 4 years' time, and that's been the way the world's always going to end, you know, since medieval times. People have always said, oh, next year, you know, or October the 2nd, and when October the 2nd comes along, they invent an excuse. Oh, it didn't happen for this reason, or we didn't pray hard enough.
Yes.
We'll wait another 7 years.
Yeah. You
know, it gives you 7 more years to sell your idea to a credulous public.
Well, some of them become, you know, the faith is even renewed and restored and emboldened because, it's just something you've invested all of your time and life and energy and belief system in. And then when it's not there, you're going to have to either drop it, which makes you look silly, or, you know, justify it somehow. It's that was actually pointed out in, oh, what was the name of the book? Now I can't remember the name of the book. The one about the flying saucer religion in the 1950s that was infiltrated by the psychologists. When Prophecy Fails.
Oh yeah, right. I remember that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's very strange to hear people talk about belief as fact, but the thing is that the way our brains work, it seems like, you know, it's the thinker think the prover proves thing. So it's interesting to go back and see how this has evolved over many hundreds of years. How did you restrict yourselves to the time period, you know, from, you know, ancient history up to whatever it's 1879 or 1880? What was the, I know you explained it in the book, but what was the reasoning behind that?
Yeah, well, in Wonders in the Sky, we just looked for a period in which people were using air transport, or at least were experimenting with balloons and things and kites and whatever much more. So it was a lot easier to find authentic or probably authentic reports up to around 1879. But after that, it just seemed that everybody was trying to design an airship. So it becomes a little bit tricky to distinguish between human technology, man-made technology, and strange objects in the sky which could never have been made by people. So yeah, 1879 just seemed like a good cutoff point to us.
Mm-hmm. I found a account a couple of years ago of, and I'm sure you've run across it, of a balloon crashing in rural France in, oh, who knows, I guess late 18th century. And people there had never seen such a thing, so they eventually attacked it with pitchforks and tried to kill it.
Yeah. We have a lot of those, actually. There are a lot of balloon accounts like that because ballooning became such a massive hobby for people in Europe that they had to be prohibited in the end. They were abolished because when they landed on thatched roofs, they started fires. So in many lands, ballooning, which was such a big hobby for a period, I mean, they're obviously not balloons piloted by people, but these sort of fire balloons that were sent up, mm-hmm. They were forbidden. So when, you know, the time came to make balloons piloted by actual people, there are all these superstitions about it, and people didn't know exactly what to think. I mean, you know, because they were abolished, it was illegal and dark and mysterious and strange. You know, new technology is often seen as something strange and esoteric. So a balloon crashing into a field with people sitting in the basket, yeah, that would be considered, you know, the work of the devil in some rural areas. I've been writing recently about photography, the origins of photography for a completely different project that I'm doing right now. And you can see that in the middle of the 19th century, photographers were considered illusionists, magicians, slightly esoteric, because they didn't want people to know exactly how they were making their daguerreotypes and their early photos. So new technology is often seen in this way as something mysterious. And, you know, in some places and in some periods, it's something that you have to kill and extinguish and destroy because it must be the work of a witch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the balloon crash that it was in Gonesse, I guess is the name of the town, but it was with a hydrogen balloon, strangely enough. They made the hydrogen, I think, by, like, pouring acid on iron or something like that. Whatever the chemical reaction would produce hydrogen, filled a balloon with this, sent it off. A bunch of crowds were cheering. The king of France was there, and then it just landed out in a field somewhere. A bunch of people decided that it was some horrible beast and stabbed it to death. And then I think as they said in the report, tied it to the tail of a horse, and the horse ran away and it tore apart as it got dragged over the ground. So they destroyed the horrible, you know, unknown thing from the sky.
Yeah, that did happen quite a lot. In fact, if you collect a lot of these balloon crash stories, they're very, very similar to the airship crash stories of the 1890s. Mm. And then again, 50 years later, they're very similar to a lot of the original flying saucer crash stories. Because, of course, flying saucers, I mean, people always think of the same cases, Roswell and so on. But if you look at the newspapers of June and July 1947, a flying saucer was crashing into a field every other day of the week. I had a collection of about 40 or 50 stories from June or July. Mm-hmm. And that was before Roswell became famous. And these balloon crash tales are very interesting. Then you have to wonder which ones are true. You know, I mean, maybe some of them are urban legends, or maybe some were written just to sell newspapers.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, that's part of the fun of finding this and then doing a little bit of research.
Well, you know, in regard to airship stories, I know that's not part of your the purview in Wonders in the Sky, but people always wonder. I wonder, you know, what's the percentage of those you think that were newspaper stories that were, you know, spread around just to sell newspapers, and what percentage of them or what part of them deal with something that was actually mysterious that people saw in the sky, or, you know, piloted vehicles?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've looked into this question a lot myself, and I want to do a book on this in the future, but I still have a lot of work to do. But if you look at how it all developed, there was a story of a balloon in the 1880s, which it provided a kind of template for later stories. It was a balloon that passes over a town in New Mexico, and it was a completely innocent little story. In the balloon, there was a Chinese girl traveling who drops a silk flower to the ground and a letter and so on, and it just happens that the next day her lover, another Chinese man, was traveling through California, stops at a place and says, "Oh, what's that? Oh, this dropped from a strange balloon in the sky. Oh, that belongs to my girlfriend. We're going to get married in New York." And he runs off to New York and meets her, because all of this has come from the fact that they just invented a China to New York hot air balloon service, which didn't exist. It's all just a newspaper fantasy. But this story provided a template for the first important airship stories of 1896. It's just a copy of that tale, but just slightly more embellished and updated, you know, for a more modern audience. It was 10 years later or more. So when you start looking at how the airship wave developed, First, you have to bear in mind that a lot of it came from a joke from the 1880s that was then transferred into the 1890s. Then you start to look at how many stories were published in that period. And most of the books published to date about the airship wave probably contain about 50 or 60 accounts, newspaper accounts, which is good number. You can extrapolate a conclusion from 60 or 70, but through Magonia Exchange and through my own studies and then with everything that was given to us by the folklorist Eddie Bullard, who's also a member of my group, we've got about 5,000, 6,000 stories now relating to the airship wave. I mean, no exaggeration at all. We're talking about at least 5,000 cuttings. And so when you use 5,000 cuttings to try to get to the truth of what's happening, it gives you more data to play with. So what I've done is to make a kind of catalogue of all of the witnesses, all of the locations, all of the dates and all of the events, codifying all of them, their names and places and so on. And I've been able to plot all of this onto a map and also chronologically to see how it's spread.
Wow.
And what you discover is that it's spread as folklore does. It's spread virally, you know, like something does on Facebook these days. And it just spread from town to town until it just became this massive thing. I mean, it didn't last very long. If you look at the airship wave, it was only a couple of months and then it was practically gone.
Yeah.
But,
1897,
I guess. Yeah, well, in fact, if you look at it, you can find accounts starting in the early 1890s, 1892.
There's
some interesting stories.
Yeah.
It actually goes up to 1899 continues into the 20th century. But the main wave itself, this big explosion of cases, was 1896, 1897.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was that newspapers developed the idea of a wooden airship with sails and a crew, and you could hear their voices from the ground and so on. But a lot of this was just an invention, and it was based on the fact that in the months previous to this, inventors had been distributing diagrams of their projected airships. Everyone was interested in inventing an airship at the time. But this doesn't mean that there weren't actual UFOs recorded at the time, because what happened was people started becoming so obsessed with airships that they went out of their houses at night, they looked up into the sky or across the valley to see if they could spot it. And that is when they started seeing strange lights and strange objects in the sky, which they didn't describe as these traditional sailing ships in the air, as we've seen so many times in books about the airship wave.
Yeah.
They often saw triangles of lights or lights of a strange color, strange movement. So even though the airships themselves were probably a journalistic creation, people were going out of their way and spending plenty of time at night looking up in the sky and documenting weird stuff. And that is the key, I think, that is the reason we should pay attention to the airship wave, not because of the airships themselves and the silly stories, but what other things people documented at the time.
Yeah, so there really, you know, back to the original thing, there really is no way to kind of root out exactly which of these 5,000 stories are based in something rather other than complete fabrication.
Well, what we do is we use the genealogical archives to check the names, the places, and the dates relating to every case.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of them, You just realize that, I mean, it describes some famous doctor called, we'll say, Joseph Jones or something like that.
Yeah.
And some prestigious man. And then you look at the census records of the time and you discover that, no, Joseph Jones was the blacksmith. and this is all a joke.
Yeah.
So it's not impossible to do good research with this. It's not impossible to check a lot of these cases, but you do have to get used to going into genealogical records and looking through the census records. It's possible to do, but it's going to take a lot of time.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Return to Magonia for a little while, which I did not read. But it appears to me it's sort of like basically you took what you were doing in Wonders in the Sky and sort of narrowed it down to a sort of a top 20 historical list. Is that correct?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, we didn't narrow down all of the cases. I mean, most of the cases don't come from Wonders in the Sky at all. It's a separate body of cases.
And it seems like there's more recent ones too.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, what we did was to choose about 20 cases that we thought might represent an anomaly and, to investigate the hell out of them, basically, and to do real science, real research, and to get down to the nitty gritty of what each case might be about. So, it's very different from Wonders in the Sky, where there's no real analysis. This is all analysis. We're really looking deeply into the lives of every witness, every place. We're, you know, looking into the topographical records, the meteorological records, and so on and so on. And using a digital planetarium, which we use one called Stellarium, which you can download onto the iPad or your iPhone or whatever. And it calculates the positions of the planets in the sky, the stars, for any moment in history, any hour on any date in history. So with all this kind of all these tools at our disposal, we can do some really good research. And in Return to Magonia, we present about 20 really good cases, very well researched, and none of it would be possible without Martin Schoff, who's another British researcher living in Scotland, who has taught me a great deal about how to analyze cases technically. I mean, he's got this brilliant mind for looking at all the, you know, at a case from every possible angle. And, together we've made a very unusual, unique, book on historical UFO incidents.
So what, I don't know about your favorite, but is there maybe one or two of the cases you want to talk about and figure and describe basically your methodology and why you think they're strong cases and maybe what other people should do when they're looking at historical cases like this?
Well, for example, I can tell you a little bit about the chapters. In the first chapter, we look at 17th century England, which was when a time when people used accounts of strange events to show that God supported their particular war or cause. And we've taken a collection of accounts called the Mirabilis Annus, which was three volumes that covered just a few years in the 1660s. And we know that some of these are probably fake, and we know that it was published as a form of political and religious propaganda. But what people hadn't realized till now with this book is that many of the stories there about strange lights in the sky and meteorites and weird things, you can calculate the position of the stars and the planets for the days that they describe, and you find out that they were describing pretty accurately what the sky was like at that time, which you couldn't have done from your imagination alone. Yeah. So, you know, using digital resources, we show that these books from the 1660s contain stories which might be authentic. But then in chapter two, we look at a very interesting case, which was basically a series of objects seen flying in the sky near the German city of Stralsund in April 1665. And the reports mention ships and flocks of birds and fire and smoke, mm-hmm. but there was this dark plate or hat-shaped object that hovered over the church of St. Nicholas for 1 hour. And we found, well, I mean, you can find it in other books in this case too, but there were witness testimonies. The witnesses seemed to have suffered from convulsions, trembling and pain in their hands and feet after the sighting. And then we looked at contemporary illustrations of the town and this sort of disc thing in the sky. And what we saw was that they were pretty good. They were quite accurate and combined with the time and date. We know what was going on in the sky at the time. And this was an anomaly. This disc thing that appears in illustrations definitely shouldn't have been there. So, yeah, I mean, this chapter gets into detail about what it could be and so on and so on. Then we get into the subject of other fiery things like flames and fireballs that have attacked ships that have been seen at sea or in the countryside. And we talk a little bit about earthquakes, and there's a connection between earthquakes and lights in the sky, and whether some of these could be explained by escaping gases and so on. I mean, we get into a lot of these cases very deeply, and we show that using science, using logical thought, you can consider all the possible explanations and still come up with the conclusion that they saw something that was, you know, it wasn't normal at all. They saw something extraordinary. One of the cases that I like is from 1829, when a group of people in Leeds in England saw what they thought was the full moon until it separated into two halves right above their heads. And then these two humanoid figures come out and start floating in the sky for about an hour. And, you know, they return to this spherical object and disappear. So using our tools and resources, we could find out whether the moon was really full on that date, and mm-hmm. the moon wasn't full on August the 20th, 1829, so it couldn't have been the moon that they saw. And then we also managed to find other cases throughout history of these luminous spherical objects in the sky that seem to contain humans or humanoid figures. I mean, there's just so many cases like this that hadn't been published before. So, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, at least we're proud of bringing these cases together for the first time. And this is, what, 130 years before similar objects started appearing in ufology.
So there's obviously precedent for these things. And the thing is that people aren't even aware that there's precedent for it. Most people are.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the first close encounter of the third kind that we found was from 1873 in Ohio. I don't know why so many strange things happen in Ohio, but that's the reason I went there about a year and a half ago.
A lot of astronauts come from Ohio, strangely enough.
Oh, well, there you go.
Or a few, more than statistically, you would think statistically possible. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
It's interesting though, isn't it? How one state could, you know, produce so many interesting cases and stories and accounts. And I know it's a very rural area, but still it's an interesting coincidence that so many interesting stories come from the same state.
Mm-hmm.
But in March 1873, these two farmers, a man and his son, were walking through the countryside when they saw a dark object fly overhead. It had fire coming out the back, I think, and it lands in front of them, and the lights go out, a door opens, and they don't mention a door, simply a figure comes out of it. And it's dressed in black, it's carrying a lantern, and it gets into a buggy, a car of some kind, wheelless and horseless, and it just disappears. It rides away, and they lose sight of it. We found that very interesting because in 1873, there were no automobiles, there were no cars, so whoever came up with this story, if it wasn't an authentic case, if it really didn't happen, had an amazing imagination, because he describes a being that comes from the sky in some kind of spaceship. It lands, and then the pilot gets into a car and drives off. You know, I mean, it's fascinating. We went there too, to this exact place, and took a lot of photographs, and it was very exciting to see these places in real life that we'd only ever seen in brittle old newspapers, you know.
Yeah, I went and tried to find the place where the Rex Heflin picture was taken in 1966 or whatever it was. You know which one I'm referring to?
Yes, I do, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's completely covered over with an industrial park now, because it's Southern California, so things spread out very quickly, especially over the last 20 years. And the only thing that's there now that's basically the same as it was is a railroad track that ran through there.
Okay.
So you can't find really any it doesn't look like it does in the picture, because there were fields then, just agricultural fields. Now it's all an industrial park. So it's kind of hard to make any kind of observation about what was going on, because you don't have any of the, except maybe in the distance, either mountains or something like that. Oh, no, it was overcast, so you really couldn't see anything. So, yeah, none of the, I was going to try and research what was going on there and, you know, go to the actual site, but there's nothing left to research. So, at least not physically.
Right.
So, I guess then you go to the next step, like you do, is researching the records and what things look like on that day and all that. It's a little difficult. I guess all we have there is the photographs, which are still kind of probably solved, but we're not that sure yet.
Well, I suppose you could get maps and photographs, and you could get the meteorological information for that date, that kind of thing.
Oh, that has been done, yeah. And it was cloudy, okay. And it was as the witness Rex Heflin described. The only thing that's really in question is what is in those pictures.
Right.
And I think that's still a legitimate debate. Not that I think it's mysterious or it's a UFO from another planet. It just sounds like it's still being debated, with good points on both sides.
Yeah. I don't know very much about that case, but I remember that you could see a UFO like through a window or something like that. Yeah, it's like,
yeah, it was
is it through a truck window or something?
Yeah, he took a picture through his truck window, and I think, and then it moved, so he took a picture through the side window, and then, a few years ago, probably about 10 years ago, the original pictures were returned to him because somebody came and took them from him, soon after the, incident, and saying they were from, either Strategic Air Command or the Air Force or something like that. And then something like, 30, 40 years later, somebody called him and said, look in your mailbox. And his pictures were in there.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's great. Yeah.
And a couple of the pictures he had talked about but nobody had ever seen were returned, which had to do with were pictures of a smoke ring, a Taurus-shaped smoke ring that was left when the object took off, he said.
Uh-huh.
And that gave the case another, interesting angle to me, because you can talk about the photographs all you want, but then you have this thing which he mentioned at the time, but nobody had ever seen the pictures, and then the pictures show up of this ring of smoke, which happens during an explosion or something like that. But what else could leave a ring of smoke ascending through the air? He said the thing took off very quickly and left that ring of smoke, so.
Wow. I know that we have cases, too, on file of rings of smoke, from historical periods. So maybe I'll have a look and see what we have. Maybe we can find something similar.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
It's always nice when someone's spoken about photographs or a document that they've never been able to show, and then finally you find it, and it seems to confirm at least that the witness wasn't lying about that, you know, whatever they saw. At least it's like finding the Holy Grail in a sense. you come up with the original document. This is what happened a couple of years ago. I was looking into a case citing by a guy called Frederick William Birmingham, who was this engineer in Australia, in Parramatta, who in the 1860s had a dream, and he dreamt that it was 1868. He dreamt that he saw this huge spaceship, or airship at least, descend before him, and the pilot came out, and he was somehow, this guy, this engineer, was somehow transported to the inside of this ship, and shown how it worked, and shown a mathematical formula, and so on and so on. And then he woke up, and we didn't really have proof that this man, this engineer, Fred Birmingham, had really ever written about this. It was just, there was this a typed up manuscript from the 1960s that said, that they said was his memorandum book. It was all transcribed from this old diary that had been destroyed. And, you know, it was very difficult to say whether it was true or not, that this engineer had really had a dream about an airship. He really had written a diary that had been, you know, lost, because all we had was this typed up manuscript from the 1960s. But then a couple of years ago, we stumbled on articles that prove that he really did have this experience, and that that what he wrote in this lost book, it must have existed. So I published something on this, and this, in a sense, for me was like a holy grail. It was like, wow, we can prove finally that this guy really did claim to have had that experience, because there are so many stories about people in the past who allegedly saw a UFO, and then later with a bit of research you discover, no, that was invented just 20 years ago for a TV documentary or a magazine article. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's good that this guy's photographs turned up, in the same way that this, you know, the existence of this old diary could be confirmed. You know, if you do a little bit of research and you're patient enough, you can prove a lot of things really happened.
Mm-hmm. Or disprove them, I guess.
Or disprove them, yeah. That's the case, maybe.
All right, how about your Uparts book? However, that is in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the subtitle is Objetos Fuera de Su Tiempo. Objects not of their, lost from their time.
Yeah, out of time or out of place art. Because, I mean, obviously it means out of place artifact. So it's like out of time, out of their time. Yeah, it's a book which I wrote with, a historian from the Complutense University in Madrid, Juanjo Sánchez Oro. And we analyze, all of the most popular, Uparts and some archaeological artifacts, the kind used by von Däniken or Zachariah Sitchin. And we go to the original sources and find out whether they are as mysterious as is generally claimed. And, you know, we did find a few interesting ones, so we can't say that the whole concept of out-of-place artifacts isn't true, but I think every single item, every single artifact that appears in the usual ancient astronaut books turned out to have a very simple explanation, or not to have existed at all. So we published this book last year, and you know, people are happy at least that we're revising this. What magazines generally say a good proof of ancient civilizations that have been lost. And it's been quite an interesting experience.
What I understand from what you just said is that did you find any of them that, well, it sounded like you said you got most of them explained. Did you find any that aren't explained?
There's a series of little spirals, like almost nanotechnological spirals that were found in Russia, but we didn't have enough information to research properly. There are some interesting archaeological artifacts that we don't completely understand, but you know, crystal skulls and so on, all of this was rejected many, many years ago and shown to have been made in workshops in the 19th century. So unfortunately, most of these artifacts either didn't exist or they just have a very, very simple explanation. And the first chapter goes into, because we distinguish between geological uparts, that is like finding a screw or a hammer or a nail inside a rock or a piece of coal.
Yeah.
We distinguish between those and later artifacts, archaeological artifacts, which have been used to support ancient astronaut theories. And if you look at the 19th century stories about geological artifacts, it seems that most of them were invented just to sell newspapers at the time, because it was a period when archaeology had just become very popular, but it was also a period when North Americans were trying to show that North America had had a fantastic golden age which could compete with the old world of Europe and ancient Greece and Egypt and so on, which is how the Book of Mormon came to be too. It was, you know, they wanted to show that the patriarchs of the Bible had walked around ancient North America. So it seems that uparts originated as a kind of fiction in the 19th century to support this idea that America had had a much greater, more advanced past than anyone could remember. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that we won't turn up one day and a genuine upart from under the ground, but it does cast a doubt on the ones that are popularly presented as proof of something.
Yeah. You mentioned the Ancestry.com earlier when you were doing research. Am I right? Every time I see that, I remember that started out as a project of the Mormon Church.
Did it really? I'm not sure that Ancestry did.
Maybe not, but they were heavily invested in genealogical information, because as I understand it, they were trying to retroactively convert everybody that had ever lived to the Mormon religion and kind of enter into their roles as Mormons.
Seriously.
This may be disproven with proper research, but that was the goal at first, and they found out that they were getting so much good information and useful information that other people could use, that they started the Ancestry.com as kind of a business. Because, you know, apart from trying to retroactively gather souls, it actually was a good historical resource.
Really? I don't know about that, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me, because a lot of the genealogical records that we have were preserved and published by the Mormon Church. And very usefully so. I mean, they've been very useful in my research, and I'm happy that they did. But it is true that a lot of these businesses that sell information about the past to subscribers, they probably do have some kind of mission in mind, whether that's political or religious. Mm-hmm. You know, Here in Europe, there isn't this business, this whole industry of find out what your great grandfather was doing and so on doesn't really exist. So it's a lot more difficult here to access genealogical records than it is in the States. So sometimes I actually have to use these American companies to access information about what happened in Britain in historical times, because it seems that in Europe there isn't so much interest, that people are happy to subscribe to these services.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it follows from your earlier a comment about people from at least in the 19th century, maybe that's continuing this one, trying to find some kind of historical basis for their ancestry or their heritage or whatever it is. Whereas people in Europe, they live in the middle of it, so they don't really care as much.
Yeah, well, you know, what I find interesting and sort of amusing is that I look at these old cases from, for example, the story from 1873. I using genealogical records, I looked for the descendants of the farmers who saw this craft land and the pilot gets into a car and drives off. Mm-hmm. And I found, you know, living descendants of these people. Mm-hmm. And I write to them and I end up seeing them on Facebook. And then it's just so weird for me that the descendants of these witnesses from UFO cases from 150 or 200 years ago are now writing little messages on Facebook, and I'm seeing them. It comes up, could I help them with their Candy Crush or whatever it is? But I don't know how that works. It just seems so weird, you know.
Yeah. All kinds of. I'm listening to your talk and I'm hearing a dog bark in Spain.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if it's a Spanish one. I wasn't listening.
I mean, I'm still old enough to think I'm hearing a dog bark in Spain over the internet right now. I had another a question about the Uparts. With a personal interest, do you know about the spark plug in the rock from California in the 1950s?
Yeah. Well, that was rejected a long time ago, wasn't it, by researchers who
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, there was so much of this. It's because a lot of objects can. I don't remember this case particularly, but a lot of objects can be calcified naturally in the ground, mm-hmm. and they become uparts. So there's a natural process in which workers have like dropped things in the countryside, and they've started to calcify, and they seem to sort of become fossils, even though they're just 30, 40, 50 years old. So it's actually possible to find things like spark plugs, coins, hammers and knives, and probably an iPhone, which is sort of semi-fossilized. So, you know, if you find a fossil that does look like it's a piece of technology, it might not be as old as it looks.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about things like, I guess it's not an out-of-place object, but... what I'm thinking of is those Chinese anchors that were, I'm still in Southern California here, found off the Palos Verdes Peninsula here in Los Angeles in the 1950s or 60s, I think. It's not really an out-of-place object. It's more kind of like, well, people don't really expect to see anchors from Chinese ships from pre-Columbian.
Right, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of artifacts that have been found in that sense. I mean, and they're still very popular. I mean, the whole idea is this thing is to show that our ancestors were either visiting each other a long time before airlines came into existence, or that if our ancestors are considered to be primitive, like North American tribes, that they couldn't possibly have made monuments themselves, or they couldn't possibly have developed parts of their culture that we consider to be too advanced for them. I don't know very much about the theory of Chinese visitors in America. I mean, hopefully there's some good evidence there. But what we do in the Uparts book is that we try to show that our ancestors were not as stupid as a lot of writers try to make out, who say that the only way they could have got this information was if they had contact with an advanced civilization from the North Pole or wherever, or whether, or from visitors from another planet. It's kind of racism in a sense. Mm-hmm. The idea that just because we think they are primitive, or maybe their modern day descendants have become alcoholics or are primitive in some way, doesn't mean that over a period of 3,000 years they couldn't have come up with inventions and science themselves. So that's part of what we do in the book. We try to revindicate the lost glories of Homo sapiens sapiens and say, we don't need theories about lost races and aliens. You know, it's not necessary.
Well, can you give an example where something seems advanced and it shouldn't be, and from these dumb people, but that's not really the true story?
Well, I mean, for example, if we look at rubber, I mean, rubber was invented by the Mayans. They had a sport, their version of football used a rubber ball. And there are a lot of studies that have been published in the last few years showing how the Mayans developed the process of making rubber. Probably 2,000 years before it was redeveloped here in Europe or in the States or wherever. Mm-hmm. And they were able to add chemical properties to rubber that have only been reinvented in the last 100 years or so. So I mean, that's a good example of how a technology was developed in ancient times. And even if the current Mayans, or maybe 500 years ago, they didn't know how this had been invented, doesn't mean that they didn't do it themselves. Because mm-hmm. the problem is that when there's no written record, there's no way to trace who invented it or who developed the science behind it. I mean, there's a lot of that, and it's been these theories, particularly. Involving ancient astronauts, most of them are based on the idea that our ancestors were too stupid to come up with all this information. And one thing that I like to mention when I'm talking about this is how a French scientist in 1877, I believe, called Dufresne, presented a case before the French Academy of Science, saying that Australia really should belong to white people and should be colonized, and that it shouldn't really belong to the Aborigines because Australia itself had fallen as an asteroid from outer space. And it had fallen into the Pacific Ocean, and of course that's what caused Noah's flood and made a lot of the mountain ranges. And because it's fallen into our property, that is our ocean, our land, our planet, Australia belongs to us now. And it's this idea that, they're like excuses always for showing that the original inhabitants of any land, if they seem primitive compared to ourselves, couldn't possibly have come up with their own culture and own mythologies and own ideas without some kind of outside influence. And as if that gives us, it's as if it creates a sense of superiority in us or something like that. I don't know. It's a strange phenomenon. It's very human. It's very sad. And it's just the idea that we're not able to acknowledge that, you know, the people in the world have had very different histories to ours. Mm-hmm. And what we consider to be primitive, maybe they consider to be completely normal.
Yes. I'm afraid I'll have to ask you to speculate. What do you think causes UFO reports, or is that even
a question that can be asked. If something is unidentified, truly unidentified, is there any speculation you have about what might be the source of it?
Well, you know, in 1996, I saw a UFO in the
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah,
I saw a rectangular, orange-colored, luminous thing in the sky in a small town called Talarubias in Badajoz in Extremadura in Spain,
mm-hmm.
and this was in 1996. And I saw this with about five or six other people, and it was very interesting. It's the first time I'd ever seen a UFO, and I haven't seen one since. It sort of lingered in the sky for about 15 minutes, I think. Before we saw it, it must have already been there. And then it suddenly disappeared as you would turn out a light, and it reappeared in a different part of the sky about 5 minutes later, and it was there for 5 or 10 minutes, and then it disappeared again. And there was no explanation possible. I mean, it wasn't a bird or a plane. It wasn't a satellite. It wasn't a light on the top of a tower. And I've no idea at all what it was, and I'll probably never know what it was. And I'd like to know what I saw, but I have the same feeling about most of the UFO cases that I've studied. I don't think we'll ever know what they are. I don't believe that they are visitors from other planets necessarily. Maybe one or two are. It would be great if that were the case.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the differences between my approach to all of this and to Jacques Vallée's approach, for example, is that I don't believe that there is a phenomenon with a capital P behind UFOs. I think that we're looking at several different kinds of phenomena happening, and there are going to be psychosocial explanations which are completely valid to explain mm-hmm. a lot of this. There are going to be natural phenomena which we've either misinterpreted or we haven't really understood yet anyway. Maybe there are also aliens visiting us on winged bicycles. I've absolutely no idea.
Yeah.
No idea at all. But, you know, because I'm not too bothered about what UFOs actually are.
Hmm.
I'm more interested in the impact of UFOs on human societies and how we envision the world and our place in it. It doesn't really bother me too much mm-hmm. what they are. In Spanish, often in conferences and on the radio, people ask me, Chris, what do you think hides behind UFOs? And I say, ufologists. And I just let them interpret that as they want.
That's perfect. That's one of the best explanations I've ever heard. In concert with the John Keel's quote a long time ago, he said something like, UFO researchers aren't telling the government what they know about UFOs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's just so much secrecy, but I think a lot of this secrecy just hides, just conceals ignorance. I mean, the government's ignorance, they have no idea what it is. Mm-hmm. Most of the time. And all this secrecy, which of course leads to, theories about conspiracies and so on, it just confuses the matter. There really should be more openness. And if the government thinks, you know, I'm saying the word government as if it's one single body.
It's composed of many, many different people with many different ideas.
If authorities are going to say anything at all about the UFO phenomenon, they should be honest and say that they have no idea what it is either most of the time. And mm-hmm. I think that a lot of these conspiracy theories would evaporate because we're so used to hearing explanations for everything because they believe that that people demand explanations. So they come up with these crazy explanations half the time that don't convince anybody. And they're just digging their own graves in that sense. They're just making the problem deeper.
Yeah, and something that I've said, I think my opinion is sort of the same as yours. It's that if you questions are asked with an idea of the answer already there.
Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's true. I mean, yeah, the people, you know, normally people who read UFO books already believe that UFOs exist. And people who debunk UFOs normally believe that they don't exist, and it's very difficult to change that.
Yeah. So in other words, my original question about what causes the reports is, to your mind, it's kind of a meaningless question at this point.
Yeah, and I think it's going to remain meaningless to me personally forever, because at least having seen one myself, I've put myself in the witness's shoes. I know what it's about. I know what it feels like. And, you know, now, years and years later, when I describe it, I feel like one of the witnesses. You know, it's like something that happened at some point in the past. I don't have any proof that it happened. I even saw it with a bunch of people I don't have any contact with anymore, because it was a girl I was going out with, and so on and so on. So I feel, you know, just like any of the witnesses who I've interviewed or who I've investigated, because it's a frustrating thing. There's nothing you can do to prove that you actually saw something, but there it was.
Yeah. Okay, completely off this off the subject. You live in Spain. You're originally born in London. Obviously, you I guess you moved when I said at the beginning when you were 19. Why did you want to move to Spain?
Well,
big question.
I can tell you the abbreviated story or the long story,
whichever you prefer.
Well, let me just say this: when I was 16, 17, 18, my parents moved around a lot, and they sort of destroyed, accidentally, to put it kindly, my education, my formal education, because I kept moving house. I never really concentrated on anything at that point, and which is why I spent most of my time in libraries and reading about UFOs and whatever. Anyway, so what it meant was that I didn't really feel I had any roots anywhere. And when I was 18, I started working in a furniture store, selling furniture and soft furnishings and whatever. And I saved up enough money to get a plane ticket, and I went to Minnesota so I could meet an author of ancient astronaut book, which interested me at that time. And I spent a while there talking to her and her father and so on. I was only 18 years old. And then I got on a Greyhound bus that took me to California. And I spent a couple of weeks there with a different writer on these subjects. And then I returned to Minnesota, and I thought, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? I'd like to stay in America, but I couldn't find a way. It was pretty weird. I walked into a YMCA, and I had about 5 weeks left before I could get a flight back home. And I had a little bit of money, but not too much. And the guy there said to me, look, if you stay here, you're going to be murdered, raped, robbed, or whatever. And I said, oh, that's not too good. And he said, well, why don't you come back to my place? And if you come back to my place, you'll be fine. You can spend as long as you want there. And, you know, these days I'd say, I don't think so.
Yes.
But I said yes. And I went with him, and he turned out to be the manager of a kind of, it was a duplex. It was for people who were drying out after having fallen into alcoholism. But these guys were like businessmen and, you know, really nice people.
A halfway house for rich people.
Yeah, I wouldn't call them rich.
Well, not rich people, a halfway house for people who hadn't completely fallen off the face of society yet.
Yeah, it's something like that. It isn't something I've encountered since. So whatever I'm describing might make more sense to you than it does to me. But basically, he let me stay there on his sofa. He had a couple of sofas, and I spent several weeks there in this place, and it was great. And Then he introduced me to his daughter. He was divorced, and I began going out with his daughter, who said, "Why don't you marry me? Maybe we could get you a green card." And I said, "Well, I don't know about that." And then she said, "Why don't you marry my mother, who was unemployed?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, but you know, just to see where it was all heading, I actually went and spoke to the mother, and she said, yeah, why not? You can move in here. I can marry you, and you could be with my daughter." And I thought, oh, God, I don't think this is what I want to do with my life. So I returned to England, where I began working in Burger King, and where I met two Spanish people. And after a few months, they said, "Why don't you come and visit us in Spain?" Which I did. I hitchhiked most of the way. I got a ferry to France. I hitchhiked to this small town called Cáceres in Extremadura. And that was good. I spent a couple of weeks there. And then I thought, well, I have to do something with my life. I don't have that much money left. I was 19 at that point. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'm going to go to India or something like that. And I envisioned myself hitchhiking across Europe to get to India. But I got to Malaga by the coast, which is just by Africa, by Morocco, mm-hmm. where I was mugged by a group of people who left me half blind and penniless in the street. And I spent 7 weeks sleeping on the street. And I returned to the small town where I had originally arrived in Spain. And I got my eyesight back and so on. And I began giving English classes until I suddenly started my own company, giving English classes, and then I lived very well for about 10 years, and during which time I spent most of my free time writing and researching and so on and so on. So that's how it all started.
That's an incredible story.
Well, I don't know. I'm used to reading about incredible stories, and my story is probably not as incredible as other people's, but it was, it helped because, by doing that, I sort of broke with my roots in a sense, and mm-hmm. I stopped being so British. I suppose my voice is still very British, but I started a new life in a new culture and in a new language. And it's paid off because I feel that my approach to everything I do is a little bit different because mm-hmm. of how, you know, my life changed so dramatically. So I suppose I'm a bit of a maverick in that sense. I'm quite independent, even in ufology, which is why I don't really read too many UFO books. I do my own research.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a good thing, actually. I had a couple other questions. One is, seeing as how you've been in Spain for so long in Europe, how do you see the community there of researchers as compared to other countries, especially, I guess, the United States, which is where I am, and I guess where most of my listeners are? How do they approach things differently?
It's still a little underdeveloped. It's people here put a lot more emphasis on field research, on interviewing people, going off and talking to the farmer and so on, which is great. It's wonderful. It's a way of getting, you know, you have more contact with witnesses and you visit the places, but there's very little effort to bring together documents published in the past. So, for example, in American ufology and in British ufology, there are these projects to bring together all the old newsletters and old articles published over the last 50 years and press cuttings and so on, and then analyze all that. It hasn't happened here yet. It's still all about field research. So that's something I'm trying to change now. Just last week, I started a Spanish chapter of my group, Magonia Exchange. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that that's going to help take research to a completely different area. I'm hoping that people can step outside what's just field research, which of course is very important, and start looking at the data and doing some real analysis with it.
Yeah, well, I think American ufology has been very focused on field research, or at least gathering data, and they still do this, but, and there's kind of a prejudice almost against the, what they refer to derisively as armchair research. But it's not armchair research. It's more like, let's take all this data that you guys have collected so carefully for so long and start looking at it in ways that haven't been looked at before, and maybe for patterns that haven't been noticed before, and see where that takes us.
Yeah, I think it's a very important step. I mean, field research is vital. That's the only way we get information at all. But once you've got all that data, you have to do something with it. Mm-hmm. And that's when you realize that not everyone's cut out to do analysis with this kind of information. And I'm probably not cut out to do field research. I'm not that kind of people person. I'd love to be, but I can't imagine myself sitting there with a microphone and interviewing witnesses day after day or week after week.
Yeah.
It's not what I do. So it's good that there are different kinds of researchers, different kinds of people working in this field. And I just hope that in the future, with the kind of analysis that I've been doing with Martin Schoff in Return to Magonia, we can start to elevate the level in a sense and start to look for those patterns that people are so sure exist and build up a chronology of everything that's happened in ufology to date. Maybe we can reach some of those truths that everyone's so desperate to find.
Yeah. What are you involved with right now? It sounds like one of the things is doing more research along the lines of Return to Magonia. And what have you? Because on your website it actually says more books to come. So what are those projects that are coming up for you?
Okay, I'll tell you in just a sec. If I don't go and do a piss, I'm going to kill myself. So just give me 1 second.
Okay.
30 seconds, I think, actually.
Okay, this is what editing's for, and that's fine. Take your time.
Oh, I don't mind if everyone finds out I need to go to the toilet. But yeah, probably.
Okay, I'll leave
back
it
in a sec.
I'll leave it in this.
Hello, I'm back.
See, well, now I've let you take a break, so I'm thinking I'll keep you on longer, but no, we'll just end with this one.
Well, as you wish. I sort of realized that my answers are extremely long-winded and whatever.
I want them to be long-winded, Chris. I like long-winded answers, and I like conversations, which is why I do this show. Also, another main reason why I do this show is to learn things from people, because I don't do the show because for any other reason except for I get to talk to somebody who I want to learn something from and whose work I enjoy. That's the main reason.
Well, I'm perfectly happy if you want to edit me and cut it up and do whatever you want.
Because I don't think I'm going to edit anything except maybe that long space in there.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I was wondering, I could probably take my iPad in there and carry on talking, but I'm glad I didn't in the end. But because the other day because I don't normally do interviews, and it's something that I avoid. I don't like the limelight. I don't like sort of sticking out very much. But also living in Spain, I mean, I'm living right now in a small town where there is absolutely nothing here. There's not even a cinema here. It closed down. There's nothing. I don't really talk. I mean, I don't speak to people. So if you ask me a question, you watch out. I'll be talking until you've gone to bed and, you know, we'll get straight into the night, because I realized that the other day in one of these interviews, I don't talk enough, which is why my answers just go on and on and on. So, you know.
No, well, that's fine. Why did you choose to go on Coast to Coast then for that interview? Because I think that was really good to have you on that show. For the vast majority of people that listen to any paranormal show, they don't hear the kind of things you said and that we're talking about right now. So why did you decide to talk a little bit more on, to push yourself out into media a bit?
Okay. I don't think I did. The thing is, I don't listen to any podcasts. I don't watch any I don't watch TV. I don't read the books, I don't read the magazines, and if you ask me about some case that's extremely famous from last year, I'll have no idea what you're talking about, because I don't follow any of these things. So Coast to Coast, for me, I didn't even know what it was. I had to look it up in Wikipedia. No idea what that was. And then, I don't know. I haven't listened to it. No idea what happened there. It's just that, you can mention any important case or ufologist or whatever, and I really need to look them up. I have no idea who is who. I spent all my life in UFO events of the last 300 years, mm-hmm. and I know who is who, and I can tell you dates and cases and places and things. But anything after 1947 is a complete mystery for me. And as I said, I mean, you know, I'm perfectly happy if you chop my answers up as much as you want, because I was thinking, God, I do go on. And the other day, actually, Jax called me and he said, "Oh, I like your interview, but try to make your answers a bit shorter." And I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll do that." And I don't know what happened.
That's because I don't really care if your answers are shorter. And the thing is, a podcast is different than a radio interview, because there's a very specific audience that know what they're going to get on certain shows. And as you say, I don't listen to anybody else's podcast. I don't have time to. Uh-huh. So, you know, what I'm doing when I'm talking to you and other people that interest me is just, I'm talking about exactly what I want to talk about, and the person is saying exactly what they want to say and the way they want to say it. And I don't edit them. The only thing I edit out is ums, uhs, coughs, and people going to the bathroom. You know?
Yeah.
And most of my shows have been live, but I can't do that as much now. So now I'm kind of being pushed, kicking and screaming into the era where people just do conversations like we're having now and not a live conversation, which to me is a completely different dynamic. And then, you know, the fringe benefit is you get to meet and talk to people that eventually become friends, and you can get a very deep understanding of why they came to what conclusions they have or what journey they're on and how that compares to yours. And I, like I said, I've made wonderful friends and had great insights on things and had tons of fun. So that's another fringe benefit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, life is like that, isn't it? I mean, it's a journey, and it's what you do during it that counts. It's not how much money you get out of it in the end.
Yeah. So we pretty much got through probably about 15 of my 20 questions. And usually at the end, the last thing I'll ask, as in normal radio shows, is what's coming up and what should we expect from you, and what projects do you have going right now? Because on your site it actually says more books to come. So what does that involve?
Well, I've been working on one particular book for the last 9 years, which is going to be a detailed history of the evolution of the alien visitation debate. In the 1980s, there were two books published the very good academic books published by Oxford University about the history of the extraterrestrial life debate, the plurality of worlds debate, the idea that our universe is teeming with life on different planets, which is something that people have believed since the ancient Greeks, where in atomism they first started thinking that maybe our planet isn't unique in the universe. But there hasn't been any real good book so far containing a history of the belief that aliens actually have come and visited us, have actually been here. So I've been working on that over the last 9 years, and I would have finished it a long time ago if newspaper archives hadn't grown up so quickly over the last 3 or 4 years, because now it's changed everything. I mean, I've found information that I hadn't dreamt existed when I started, so I've had to look at my original theories and so on and revise everything. So I have that book, which is called Alien Artifacts, because coincidentally, it seems that the idea that aliens visit us or send their technology to our planet seems to occur in 50-year periods. I mean, the first case of interest was in 1847, mm-hmm. was when a piece of art or technology supposedly arrived on planet Earth from another planet, 1847. And then, of course, 1897 is when you have the airship wave, and then 1947 is when the whole flying saucer period started. So it divides itself into these convenient 50-year periods. That's one book I'm working on anyway. I'm hoping I'll finish it this year. Then I also have some other projects. A couple of years ago, I started looking for evidence that our ancestors believed in alien visits, flying saucers and so on, but in the 19th century. And it's very difficult to prove, because most of the documents that we have access to are scientific books and articles in which the author, normally a renowned scientist, said that, yes, there is life on Mars, and there might be life on Jupiter and so on. But they didn't normally add anecdotes of people who said they had encountered aliens from other planets. So how can you find out whether 100 or 200 years ago people believed in alien visitation? Well, one way is to look at newspaper reports, but generally speaking, in newspapers, they might have described a strange object from the sky, even a piloted one, but most of the time they didn't associate that with alien visits. So you have to sort of count that out. Then how else could you prove that our ancestors believed in alien visitation? Well, I started looking at stories, reports of people with mental problems, mental illness, schizophrenics, alcoholics and so on, people who had hallucinations. And I reached the conclusion that, and I need to develop this a little bit more, but it's what I'm doing right now. I reached the conclusion that if you hallucinate alien visits, if you hallucinate that someone has come from Saturn and is following you in the street, or if you personally believe that you've come from another planet, it seems to, well, it suggests that there's an underlying belief in society that such things can happen, or at least they're within people's imaginative grasp. Mm-hmm. So I've been looking at accounts of people with mental illness and seeing what kind of thing they said were happening to them. Mm. And it's amazing. There's at least 150 years of people saying that their privacy has been invaded by aliens from other planets, that they were transported to other star systems, that they themselves are from a family of aliens, or they arrived on this planet 30 years ago, and so on. And then, of course, most of these people were locked away in hospitals, jails, asylums, and forgotten about. But the reports are still there, so it gives me a clue as to what people seemed to believe at the time, or at least they believed that that's possible. So anyway, that is another project I'm working on. Mm-hmm. A book that I'm finishing at the moment is about, is a completely different subject. It's about supernatural images and particularly faces. Here in Spain, one of the most important paranormal episodes, to call it something, was early in the 1970s, a small house in a very small village.
Oh, I know this one.
Yeah, do you? It's
the faces appearing on the walls?
That's the one. That's it. And It's an interesting case because it attracted a massive amount of interest, but literally thousands of people stopping by at this tiny house that belonged to a very poor family, you know, just to have a look at the faces. There was police intervention. It became such an important story at a national level. All the newspapers, the government had an opinion, and so on and so on. And
where was this?
This was in a tiny place called Belmeth.
That's
where
it.
I've been told that there isn't even a bar there anymore. There's nothing. There's no hotel. You can't stay there overnight. There's nothing there. Maybe a small shop, and that's all. It's in an area called Jaén in here in the south of Spain. And I was in a this subject had never really interested me very much, you know, but I was in a conference about 3 months ago, and this guy was talking about the faces of Belmeth, Las Caras de Belmeth, they're called, which is widely considered the most important paranormal event in Spanish history, if not the world, because people here consider this, you know, it's like Roswell. It's like the Spanish Roswell in a sense, you know, the degree of importance that it's given. I raised my hand in the conference to ask a question, and my question was going to be, have any other cases like this ever been documented? But the guy who was talking didn't want me to speak. I think someone said to him, don't let him ask you a question because he's really skeptical about this sort of thing. Because I have a reputation of being a skeptic here.
Yes.
And so I didn't get to ask my question. So I thought I'd look into it myself. So for the last few months, I've been collecting every story under the sun of faces that have appeared on walls and windows and floors and ceilings just to show that this Spanish case isn't as unique as is often believed. But I'm not doing this as a kind of revenge against the guy who didn't let me speak in the conference, but to show that the Spanish case fits into a much wider picture of this belief, at least, that supernatural images of people's, you know, the faces of deceased people can actually appear on walls and in strange places. And it's something that happens even today. If you pick up a newspaper, sometimes it says a wardrobe's got a weird face in it, and the house, and then the people in the house feel that they've been cursed and they're going to burn the wardrobe. It's a very similar idea. So anyway, I'm looking into this for another book. And Martin Schoff and I are also looking at all of Charles Fortes' cases from his books. We're going to extract them and do a good detailed scientific analysis of every single case in every Charles Fortes book. It hasn't been done before.
No.
And so we're going to spend the year doing that too. And also Return to Magonia, which is doing very well. People have given us really good feedback so far. This was only half of the cases that we'd prepared for publication, but we didn't want to publish a big fat book. So hopefully we'll be able to bring out a second part of that book too. Well, as you can see, I'm doing a lot of different things at the same time.
Yeah. How do you even have time to talk to me?
It's amazing what unemployment can do for one, isn't it?
Yes. I found out the same thing. I don't think that I could have worked on putting out this, even just a collection, without having the work thing shut off for a while.
Yeah. So I'm temporarily unemployed, but voluntarily this year, I should say. So I'm spending the whole year doing things with all this information that I've collected over the last 20 years or so.
Okay, well, I hope it sounds like we're going to see more of it, and that would be great, because it's I think you're filling a part of the research and analysis that nobody else has really specialized in, at least to the degree you have. I guess there have been, but they haven't put out these books like you have.
Yeah, someone had to do it, and honestly, it wasn't possible before. 10, 15 years ago, none of this would have been possible. This is all possible now because of the digitalization of the world's libraries and the dedication of people like the members of my group, Magonia Exchange, who over the years have collected an amazing amount of information. And, you know, the fact that I can manage all of this data in my iPad or my computer and so on, it wouldn't have been possible 15 or 20 years ago. So, you know, now is the time to, you know, to get this done. And I hope other people start, doing the same kind of research as Martin Schoff and I have done. Mm-hmm. And I hope the next 20 years in ufology are going to be a lot more productive than the last 20 years.
I think that that movement is growing to try and look to the past and to see how it affects, you know, how it affects how we think about things now and how things are going to be going forward. Thanks so much, Chris, for spending way more time than you thought you were going to with me.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Morning when I was out shopping, though you'll find it hard to believe, a little blue man came out of the crowd and timidly tugged at my sleeve.
I love you,
said the little blue man.
I love you to bits. I love you.
He loved me, said the little blue man, and scared me right out of my wits. I hurried back to my apartment. I rushed in and I closed the door. But there on the desk stood the little blue man, who started to tell me once more.
I love you,
said the little blue man.
I love you to bits. I love you.
He loved me, said the little blue man, and scared me right out of my wits. 4 weeks after that, I was haunted, though no one could see him but me. Right by my side was the little blue man, wherever I happened to be.
I love you.
One evening in wild desperation, I rushed to a rooftop in town, and over the side pushed the little blue man, who sang to me all the way down.
I love you,
said the little blue man.
I love you to bits. I love you.
He loved me, said the little blue man, and scared me right out of my wits. I whispered, thank goodness that's over. I smiled as I hurried outside. But there on the street stood the little blue man, who said with a tear in his eye,
I don't love you anymore.